Chapter 21.
It took me a couple of hours to work out how to make my trusty tracking spell function. I easily found several memories that I could use to power the spell. It was figuring out how to create the link to Molly that was hard. Usually, I would use one of the trusty traditional methods for directing thaumaturgy. A lock of hair, a fresh drop of blood, fingernail clippings, etc. That wasn't going to work, obviously. I couldn't touch them, even if I had them. So instead of tracking Molly with physical links, I tried using memories of her in their place. It worked, sort of. The first tracking spell led me to the hotel that had once hosted a horror convention known as SplatterCon. It was closed now and deserted. I guess maybe all the deaths at SplatterCon had taken a toll on the hotel in the civil court cases that followed the phobophage attacks. I took a quick spin through the place, hardly even flinching before I stomped through one wall after another. Except for a few transients who had broken into the building and were squatting there, I found nothing. I went back over my work. The memory I'd used was one that had stuck in my head for some reason, of Molly here in this building. That must have thrown off the spell. It had homed in on this place because it had been part of the memory I used to create the link. I tried again, this time omitting the background and picturing only Molly against an empty field of black. This second attempt took me to a police station from which I had once posted bail for Molly's boyfriend. I figured I'd bungled the spell somehow, but took a quick look around anyway, just in case. No Molly.
"Okay, smart guy," I said to myself. "So, what if the memory image you're using is too old? You're tracking her memory self to a memory location, which means you have to think of her as she is now to find where she is now, right?" "Theoretically," I said to myself. "Right, so test the theory." "Well, obviously. Although discussing a problem with yourself is almost never a good way to secure a divergent viewpoint. In fact, talking to yourself is often considered a sign of impending insanity," I noted aloud, which hardly seemed encouraging. I shook off the unsettling thought and worked the tracking spell again. This time, instead of using one of my earlier memories of Molly, I used my most recent one. I pictured her in her cast-off clothing and rags, as she'd been at Murphy's place. Forming a memory into an image that would support the energy required for a spell isn't as simple as closing your eyes and daydreaming. You have to produce it in exact, even fanatical detail, until it is as real in your mind as any actual object. It takes a lot of practice and energy to do that, and it is why people use props when they set out to do magic. A prop can be used as an anchor, saving a spellcaster the effort of creating not just one, but multiple mental constructs, and supporting them all in the state of perfect focus and concentration. I had learned how to do magic the hard way, first, all of it in my head. Only after I'd proved I could do it without the aid of props did Justin tell me that it was even possible to use them. Over the years, I'd practiced fairly complex thaumaturgic spells without props maybe once a season, keeping my concentration and imagination sharp. It was a damn good thing I had. Working magic as a ghost was all about doing it au naturel. I reached into my memory to produce the construct I'd need to stand in for Molly in the tracking spell. At the time, I'd been handed a lot to process, and I hadn't really taken stock of exactly what kind of shape Molly was in. I'd seen that she was under strain, but upon closely reviewing the memory, I was somewhat shocked at how gaunt and weary she looked. Molly had always been the sort of young person who almost glowed with good health. After 6 months on her own, she looked like an escapee from a gulag, scrawny, tough, and beaten down, if not broken. I added more than that to the image. I imagined her cheery goodwill, the self-loathing she still sometimes felt for the pain she'd caused her friends in the days before I agreed to teach her. I thought of her precise, orderly approach to her studies, so much different from my own, her diligence, and the occasional arrogance that pretty much every young wizard has until they've walked into enough walls to know better. I thought of the most powerful force in her life, a deep and abiding love for her family, and added in the desolation she must be feeling to be separated from them. Eager, beautiful, dangerous Molly. I held that image of my apprentice in mind, drew together my will, and tapped into the recollection of one of my more memorable tracking spells, all at the same time. I established the pattern of the modified version of the spell I'd had to cobble together, walked, chewed bubblegum, and released the spell with a murmured word. The power surged out through me, and a precise, powerful force spun me into a pirouette. I extended my left arm, index finger, pointing, and felt a sharp tug against it each time it passed an easterly point of the compass. Within a couple of seconds, I stopped spinning, rotated a little past the point, and then settled back slightly in the opposite direction. My index finger pointed straight at the heart of the city. "Crombie," I said, "eat your heart out." I followed the spell to Molly. I pulled my vanishing act and went zipping downtown a few hundred yards at a time. I paused to check the spell twice more and correct my course, though by the third check I was starting to feel like a human weather vane. I had to stop more frequently as I got closer to make sure I was moving in the right direction, and the trail took me down into the great towers within the loop, where the buildings rose high enough to form what felt like the walls of a deep ravine, a man-made canyon of glass, steel, and stone. I wasn't terribly surprised when the spell led me to the lower streets. Some of the streets downtown have two or even three levels. One is up on the surface, with the others stacked below it. A lot of the buildings have upper and lower entrances and parking as well, doubling the amount of access to the buildings within those blocks. There were also plenty of empty spaces, pseudo-alleyways, walkways, and crawl spaces. Here and there, abandoned chambers in the basements and sub-basements of the buildings above sat in silent darkness, waiting to be remade into something new. The commuter tunnels could connect down there, and there were several entrances to the insane, deadly labyrinth beneath the city known as Undertown. Chicago cops patrolled the lower streets on a regular basis. Things came slinking out of Undertown to prowl the darkness. Traffic would blaze through on the actual streets, which were occasionally only separated from the sidewalks by a stripe of faded paint. All in all, it's not the sort of place a sane person will casually wander through. I found Molly standing in one of the narrow alleyways. Snow had fallen through a grate 20 feet overhead and covered the ground. She was dressed in the same rags I'd seen the night before, with her arms clenched around her stomach, shivering in the cold. There was a fresh, purpling bruise on her cheek. She was breathing heavily.
"Again?" said a cool, calm woman's voice from farther down the alley, out of sight.
"I'm tired," Molly said. "I haven't eaten in a day and a half."
"Poor darling. I'm sure death will understand and agree to return another time."
There was a sharp hissing sound, and Molly threw up her left hand, fingers spread. She spat out a word or two, and flickering sparkles of defensive energy spread from her fingertips into a flat plane. Molly simply didn't have a talent for defensive magic, but this was the best shield I'd ever seen the grasshopper pull off. A hurtling white sphere hit the shield. It should have bounced off, but instead it zipped through the shield, its course barely bent. The sphere struck Molly in the left shoulder and exploded into diamond glitter shards of ice. She let out a short, harsh grunt of pain and staggered.
"Focus," said the calm woman's voice. "Use the pain, make the shield real with your will. Know that it will protect you. Again."
Molly looked up with her teeth clenched, but instead of talking, she raised her left hand once more, and another ball of ice flew at her. This one hit the shield and went through, but its path was attenuated more significantly than the last. It flew past her, barely clipping one arm. She gasped and sank to one knee, panting.
Magic taxes the endurance of anyone who uses it, and if you use magic you aren't particularly skilled with, you get worn down even faster. A shiver to see Molly like that. I knew how she felt. When Justin began teaching me how to create protective shields, he threw baseballs at me at top speed. When I failed, I was hit with a fastball moving at more than 80 miles an hour. Justin said pain was an excellent motivator and that the activity was good training. When I had been teaching Molly how to shield, I hadn't used anything more painful than fluffy snowballs and rotten fruit.
"That will do for now," said the woman's voice. "Tomorrow we will move up to knives."
Molly shuddered and looked down.
The speaker came walking calmly down the alley to stand over Molly.
It was my fairy godmother, the Lenanshi. Leah was beautiful, beyond the loveliness of mere humanity, but it was a stark, hungry, dangerous beauty that always reminded me of a hunting cat. She was tall and pale, her hair the color of autumn leaves at sunset. Her ears were very slightly pointed, though I wasn't sure she hadn't done that to herself in order to conform to mortal expectations. She wore a long gown of green silk, wholly unsuitable to the task of protecting a mortal from the weather. But as she was one of the most powerful she of the winter court, I doubted she even noticed the cold. She reached out a hand and touched Molly's hair with her fingertips.
"Why?" Molly asked, her voice barely more than a whisper. "Why are you doing this to me?"
"Obligation, child," Leah replied. "Favors owed and loyalties given."
"You owed it to Harry to do this to me?"
Molly asked.
"Nay, child, not me. But my queen is committed to him through ancient law and custom. She dispatched me to continue your training in the art, and pain is an excellent teaching tool."
"Harry didn't believe that,"
Molly said, her voice brittle.
"He never hurt me."
The Lenanshi stooped and seized Molly's chin, jerking my apprentice's face up to meet her inhuman gaze.
"Then he wronged you badly, child," Leah replied, enunciating each word sharply. "He cheated you of the legacy he lived and suffered to acquire. I am not teaching you how to tie knots in a rope or to bake pastries. I am making you ready to face battle and emerge alive."
"I have faced battle," Molly said.
"In which you were shot, of all things, by a mere mortal foot soldier," Leah said, contempt flavoring her words. "You nearly died, which would have been greatly humiliating to your mentor, and by extension to my queen."
"What does it matter to Mab?"
Molly said, her voice bitter.
"He's dead."
Leah sighed.
"Mortals can be so obsessed with useless detail. It grows tiresome."
"I don't understand," Molly said.
"Your mentor took an oath of fealty to my queen. Such oaths are not to be made lightly, and they place mutual obligations on both parties. Minor details do not excuse either party from its responsibilities."
"His death is a minor detail?"
"As these things go," Leah said. "Of course it is. You're all mortals. Even the life length of a wizard is something brief and transitory to an immortal." "Similarly, extending her hand to the assistance of those her vassal knew in life is a minor detail. If you live another 3 centuries, it is little more than a long season to the Queen of Air and Darkness."
Molly closed her eyes.
"He made her promise to take care of me?"
Leah blinked at her, politely baffled.
"No, of course not, child. He took an oath of fealty. She is one of the she. The oath binds her as tightly as it does him. Just as when I was," Leah shivered, "unable to perform my duties to young Dresden, Mab assumed those responsibilities until I could be restored to them. Thus does she now do for you through me."
Molly wiped a hand over her eyes. She shook her head and rose to her feet, moving slowly.
"Did he know? I mean,
Did he know Mab would do this?
I should have, I said quietly. If I'd stopped to think about it for 2 minutes, I should have known. But neither of them heard me.
I knew the boy well, Leah said. Better than ever he realized. Many a night did I watch over him, protecting him, and he none the wiser. But I was not privy to his mind or his heart.
Molly nodded slowly. She looked at Leah for a long moment. My godmother simply watched her, waiting until Molly nodded to herself and said,
His shade is in town, looking for the person who killed him.
The Lenanshi's pale red-gold eyebrows flew up. It was one of the most drastic reactions I had ever seen from her.
That seems unlikely,
Molly shrugged.
I used my sight. It's his ghost, all right. A construct couldn't have hidden from me.
6 months after his death?
The Lenanshi murmured.
It is rare for a shade to arise after the season in which it was made, and he was slain last autumn.
Her eyes narrowed.
Interesting. She tilted her head, studying Molly. What is your condition?
Molly blinked dully once before she said,
I need to curl into a ball and sleep for a week. I'm starving. I'm cold. I think I'm getting a cold. I hurt everywhere. I would...
Molly paused and eyed Leah.
Why do you ask?
The she only smiled in answer. Footsteps sounded heavy and quick, and a small crowd appeared at the far end of the alley. They were all rough-looking men, carrying an assortment of guns, blades, clubs, and axes. They dressed exclusively in black, to the extent that it looked like they all shopped in the same store. They were also wearing turtlenecks, every single one of them. Talk about weird. Molly let out a hiss.
Servitors! How did they find me here?
I told them where to look,
Leah said calmly.
Molly whirled to her. You what?
I didn't share your location with the Fomor themselves, child, just with some of their guard dogs. They think that if they catch you and return you to the Fomor, they will gain great honor. And I did not give them enough time to contact their masters for instructions, she smiled, showing daintily pointed canines.
Initiative in an underling can be such a troubling thing.
Molly made a disgusted sound.
I don't believe this.
20 armed thugs kept striding forward, exuding the calm that comes only from professionals who are not hurrying, keeping their spacing smooth. They were all glaring at Molly. Leah smirked, already fading out of sight.
It is good training, child.
She vanished, Cheshire Cat style, only she left her voice behind instead of her smile.
Let us see what you have learned.